listener. Hello and hello, Julio.
What?
I know, I'm doing hello, my British Maria. Hello. Hello, hello, hello.
Dude, you should be talking like this. Hello, Maria. I'm from Southern California.
The California accent. Oh, no. I love Southern California. We love all of your state. We know that you guys got heck of a lot of accents in your state. So, you know, we're getting to the end of the Futuro Media winter break. It's almost the end of 2018. What the hell? How did that happen? But, you know, for your final treat of the year, we're going to reshare one more episode for all of you.
And I love this episode. This one is one of my favorite in the thick of 2018, even though I wasn't there. But it was great to hear you, Maria. It was the live in the thick from Los Angeles, L.A., with actress Judy Reyes from Scrubs and Claws, USC professor and author Manuel Pastor, and one of our favorite ITT all-stars, the very talented, the very hilarious Cristela Alonso.
Yeah, so this was our live recording in L.A., and it was a really important and fun conversation about immigrant rights and the role that the state of California plays in national social movements. And you know what's funny, Julio, is that we had one comedian, one actress, but the guy who made us laugh the most was the deadpan USC professor Manuel Pastor. Everybody, you're really going to enjoy this one. Here we go.
Okay, Maria, dale play. Dale play.
Va play.
Play.
All right, all right, all right. Thank you so much. Welcome to In the Thick. We're recording live here in Los Angeles. This is a show about politics, race, and culture from a POC perspective. My name is Maria Hinojosa. And today I am without my dear co-host, Julio Ricardo Varela. But we are recording a live show with one of our all-stars, Cristela Alonso. Yay! Back with us, you know, from the movie Cars 3 and Cristela stand-up.
Yes, I'm here, guys. By the way, first Latina lead in any Pixar movie. That was me, Cruz Ramirez, in Cars 3.
Órale!
So.
Órale! Manuel Pastor is a professor at the University of Southern California. His most recent book is State of Resistance. Welcome, Manuel. And Judy Reyes, a dear friend of mine. Right now you can see her in Claws, one of my favorite TV shows right now. You may know her from Scrubs, also from Devious Housewives.
Devious Maids.
Sorry.
From the Mark Cherry, who's the creator of Desperate Housewives. That happens a lot.
Judy, it's great to have you on the show for the first time.
Yay! Thank you. Woo! There's a lot of really smart people in here. So I'd like to apologize in advance.
Actually, you know...
And there's a lot of movie stars in here, so I want to apologize in advance.
There are a lot of movie stars. So, for today's show, we're going to talk about politics, we're going to talk about immigration, and we're going to talk about pop culture and life. And we really want to look at these issues through the prism of California. So right now, just to kind of give you guys a little bit of a backdrop, we know that immigration policy has essentially been the issue of our time, right? Under the Trump administration, of course, things have taken a different turn. In 2017, there was a 30% increase in immigration detentions, and the courts are drowning in these cases. And we're going to be talking about how some of this impacts our own families, like Cristela, where your family is being impacted by citizens being denied their passports. So California right now does seem to be on the front line of the immigration debate. You've got a population of about potentially more than 2 million undocumented residents.
It's about 2.7 million undocumented Californians, really. And that's really important to think about because the folks who are undocumented in California, two-thirds of them have been in the country for longer than a decade. They're deeply settled into the community. And so every time the sort of deportation regime comes around, it's disrupting a family, it's disrupting a business, it's shredding a community, because these are people deeply embedded in our social fabric.
So Manuel, you talk about the state of California. So, you know, In the Thick is a national show, but your life's work right now is looking at the state of California, and you call it the state of resistance. So what is it that the rest of us need to know about the state of resistance in California and how it helps us in the rest of the country?
Well, you're right. The title of this most recent book, State of Resistance, is actually a bit of a play on words because it's about California and its resistance, but it's also trying to pull out the lessons from California for the resistance nationally and what is the state of resistance nationally. And I think it's kind of crucial to realize that in some ways the United States is right now passing through its Prop 187 moment. Prop 187 was the proposition passed by California voters in 1994 that denied social services and even educational services to undocumented immigrants.
I mean, Prop 187, for those of us who are old enough to remember, I mean, in many ways, it was like the beginning of what we're seeing in the Trumpian world. It was Governor Pete Wilson, a Republican from California, basically saying, vote to deny undocumented immigrants in the state of California all access to any kind of government support at all?
Yes, and it was sold in sort of the same way, because what people forget is that in that same era that Prop 187 was passed because of the anti-immigrant hysteria here in California, half of the country's net job losses in the recession of the early 1990s, aerospace-driven, happened in California. And people forget that in the late 1980s, Rush Limbaugh began his talk radio career here in Sacramento. So we had this sort of perfect combination of demographic anxiety blamed on immigrants, economic uncertainty, and profiteering from political polarization.
All right. Do you think that California is actually setting the example? Is the rest of the country kind of saying, yes, like California, so shall we?
Well, but in a bad way, like that
uh-oh,
shitty period in our history, the rest of the country seems determined to replicate it. So what the book is really trying to do is to say, how did California go from being that to being a state that has raised its minimum wage to $15 an hour, one of the first two states to do it? A state which has proudly declared itself to be, quote unquote, a sanctuary state under something called the California Values Act, which is negating cooperation with immigration and customs enforcement. A state which is a leader on climate change. A state which is finally deincarcerating its prison population. And a state where young people are stepping up and voting. How did we have that arc of change? And that's the lesson or set of lessons that need to be pulled out from California for the nation as a whole.
All right, Cristela, as you're listening to Professor Manuel Pastor give this analysis of California, what's going on for you? Are you like, yeah?
Being born and raised in Texas, I see that, you know, the California that you describe is the Texas I grew up and still live in a way, when I go visit family. So, you know, it's kind of like a different day, same shit. You know, it's weird because I come from a place where we do not have any opinions because we don't think they matter. So it is hard to know the history, understand how we got there, but still at the same time feel like there was nothing we could do to change that history. Because, you know, I grew up in the hood. I grew up in a border town. And let me tell you, like, people want to give these, like, right now, especially after the Trump administration, everybody wants to do those wall decal sayings like live, love, laugh and all that stuff and everything. And people in my neighborhood are like we got to fucking work, eat, sleep. You know what I mean? Right. And for me, I would love to believe that before I die, my people back home can get to a place where California is right now, because I see the blueprint. I see where it was, I can see where it can go, and I think, especially in such a political year, midterms, I see change, I see attention coming from Texas, and I wonder, can we be that? I was born and raised by an immigrant single mom who told me that this country was the best country ever. She was the person that believed the words on the Statue of Liberty, that they welcomed the poor, the hungry, everything, and I want to know where that went. Everybody that considers themselves patriots, for some reason, forget the Statue of Liberty is a symbol of this country, you know? And for me, I want to know, like, what are we doing to get there? So for me, it's like the people that are quote unquote woke, you know, that became quote unquote woke after the Trump administration, that are now like, they keep saying like the blue wave and blah, blah, blah and everything, which is great. We need those people. But can you also give us credit to the ones that have been on the bottom fighting for this shit forever? You know, it's like, welcome to the party. Where the hell have you been? Did you bring beer?
And what kind of beer? Judy, you're cracking up over there.
I'm like, damn. I mean, I don't disagree with you at all. And I wasn't unfamiliar with the original history of California. But what I do know is that in terms of what we do and even what you do professionally in terms of following your passion, that energizes you, number one. And in California, I know that if all this went down in the 80s, what shit like that breeds is outrage, is intolerance. And speaking of my profession, I know that the 90s bred all these African-American sitcoms and shows of color that were healthy with the messaging and the comedy. And that contributes to the shift, because I think in terms of art, that picks it up first, like the comedians pick it up first. Like yourself, because you got to make a joke out of it to survive. And you get people's attention that way, through film, through television, through comedy, and breaking off, insisting on letting people know and speaking out and letting them know that they're not alone. It's activism, you know, in terms of what we do, but that's how the people respond and change. And that's the positive way, or the positive thing that's happening with this era in terms of the Trump administration. Desperate to find a way where we can make a difference. And it's really motivating people to do things like what we're doing right
so
now.
So do you feel that, I guess for the both of you as actors, do you feel like what you're doing is making a difference? Do you feel like it's, or is it important because, you know, it's, I'm so glad that the both of you are working, right? That you're having an impact. Do you sometimes feel like,
I'm not working. Judy's working. I know, like, you are very gracious to say that I am working. I am not working. But I love Claws.
We do. We love Claws.
Claws is just a really
you.
Good ass show.
But we love that
show. That's why she's got time for Beto, man.
Well, actually, no, it's true. I actually made a conscious choice to not work. I stepped away from all my work after the Trump election, after the election of 2016, because I wanted to go back to my community and see how I could help, because I felt like it was important to me. The work has to be done in the way that Judy does it, too. Because, see, I remember watching you in Scrubs, and I remember wanting to act and feeling like you gave me hope because you were a nurse. You actually were smart. You were tough. You had power, and that is something that I think people take for granted. We don't have to be written up in these characters where we're completely poor and then we just stay poor. We can actually empower people by showing that you are in that room, you have that job, and you're on the same level as everybody else on that show. For me, that was empowering. See, I think that we empower the wrong way sometimes. I think that we always want to empower by rags to riches story, which is fine. We need those stories because, hell, most of us are rags and we hope to end up in riches, right? But we also need to show the empowerment comes from showing that we can all attain that level that we never thought as children that we could attain.
Because it has to be visible, right?
She's visible. She was visible for me.
Exactly. She yeah, was. Exactly.
That requires an enormous amount of luck. I'd like to just cop to... You know what I mean?
Well, because
once you clear that hurdle of getting like a great role, like I was blessed enough to get on Scrubs, then you try to hold on to that or perpetuate that. And often what happens in the business is now you get the sassy receptionist, the sassy maid, the mm-hmm. sassy this and the sassy that. And then you have to make tough choices to say, no, I can't do that. You know, I'm not going to do that anymore. And sometimes, you know, that requires a change in ethos and a change in your camp. You know, you got to fire some people.
Manuel, from an academic place, you know, the state of California does house, in fact, the movie business, the television business. Can you put what the work of these actors into the context of what you call the state of resistance in California? Is there a connection there that we need to know that this is a state that also wants artists to be here, even though this was also a state that blacklisted artists not too long ago?
So I'm going to do the usual academic thing of pretending to answer your question while I sort of chart it.
At least he's honest. All right.
Because one thing, and I will loop back to Hollywood, where I think it's important to realize is that the transformation in California was not like a magical accident or simply because the demography changed. It was really the work of a lot of hard organizing that involved patience and power and program, laying out a real long-term strategy for building grassroots power, including having undocumented immigrants help to mobilize voters to change the electorate. It involved a pretty hard-headed analysis of power and an engagement with something called integrated voter engagement, which is electoral mobilization, but based in community organizing. And it involved laying out a kind of alternative program, community benefits agreements, how to do better policing, how to do a better environment, how to really show people that another world is possible and we can actually get there. And the way in which I think Hollywood and culture fits in is kind of giving people both a sense of the possible, an inspiration that they can see themselves and that they can see themselves as actors, not just on a stage, but as actors in the world that can actually have an impact and change California. So what I really see when you talk to particularly young people in California, there's a lot of problems. One of the things that I like to say about California, there's a great expression in Spanish, se cree muy muy, right? He believes himself to be very, very, you know, he's conceited. California, se cree muy muy. We're very conceited about who we are, but we've got big problems here, but we also have big hopes that we can actually mobilize and change and make a difference.
You know what I'm still stuck with is the fact that that you would have had a moment in California where Governor Pete Wilson and Prop 187, which was so blatantly anti-immigrant, could actually have been proposed and succeeded in a state when now if anybody tried to bring Prop 187 into California, I mean, it would be a statewide revolt, I imagine.
Yes, I mean, the politics have changed dramatically, but what you need to realize is the demographic change in California between 1980 and 2000 is exactly the demographic change the U.S. is going through between 2000 and 2050. California was America fast forward. So we got our Trump moment before anyone else, and it was really pretty shitty. And so now I think things have really changed. But, you know, partly, again, it was the demographic change, and I think in part people beginning to realize that what immigration brings is energy and enthusiasm and Korean taco trucks. Nothing wrong with that, right?
On every corner.
But that it's also really that people buckled down. They got kind of tired of losing. And that's really the hope that's going on now in 2018 with the midterms. You're seeing an Andrew Gillum in Florida. You're seeing a Stacey Abrams in Georgia and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. People are tired of losing, and they're also tired of moving to the middle. They want to develop a program and a politics that can move the middle toward the progressive side of the equation.
So, Judy, I actually want to bring us back to New York, right? Because that's where you grew up. And Cristela talked about the Statue of Liberty and, you know, what her mom in Texas was thinking about. But, you know, this is a city where you grew up as the daughter of Dominican immigrants. And I'm just wondering, like, what was the politics that was happening in your home there? Like, what was the understanding of your role as Dominicanos in New York? Like, did your family say, yeah, no, somos Americanos and we're going to vote and we're going to, or were they more circumspect about their relationship to this country?
You were mentioning the Statue of Liberty, and every time we had any relative that came to visit New York City, we got on the subway all the way downtown. We got on that ferry. We went in that statue, and we walked all the way to the arm until they shut down the arm. Then it was only the car. and that's the relationship. And then we'd go to the World Trade Center. And that's unbelievable regard for the city, the country. Definitely, my parents and my family were super, super Dominicano. You know,
and that's what significa. Oh,
significa limpiando la casa todos los sábados, no, cleaning the house every Saturday, playing music, eating the food, speaking Spanish as a first language, going there on Christmas and spending an entire summer.
No consonants in Spanish.
Eso sí es verdad. Los cubanos tampoco.
No, por favor.
Ni los puertorriqueños, we can go down the list. But the Caribbeans have company in that regard. But very proud to be Dominicans, very proud to have American children. But I think there was not an unrealistic grasp of who we were in terms of, I don't know if it was because we were girls, but because we were also, you know, Latinos, and my parents, I think, or my father in particular, were aware that we were minorities in this world. You know, don't get in trouble, don't make trouble. Do your work, and that was it. Do you know what I mean? But there's a sense of understanding that you have being a Dominican American that, you know, has escaped your parents because all they want to do is work hard so that they can get you to college, work hard so that they can get you everything, you know, and not sacrifice how they got here and everything they were able to build. Do you know? But what I know is growing up here at my age is that this is my country. And this is my parents became citizens as well because they understood that there was nothing they could do without being able to vote. And they had to set the example. You know, it's about walking the walk. And that's a tough decision. A lot of people still, a lot of Latinos still think that if they vote, you know, ya, or they become citizens, that's it for them. You know, they've surrendered or abandoned their homeland forever. And that's really not true.
So, interestingly, you're talking about love of this country, right? And that is something that we as immigrants or children of immigrants, we do. We got this love thing for this country, right? My husband often says to me, ay, es que tú quieres tanto a este país. You love it too much. That's why all of this is so upsetting for you. But actually what's upsetting to me, I think, is the fact that people like us, this is a Latino-Latina panel, that somehow our patriotism and everything about us is being questioned. I'm looking at you, Cristela, because this is actually touching you in a way so deeply personally that I totally freaked out when this happened to you and me on Twitter, when we were talking on Twitter.
Uh-huh.
And the story had broken that there were Latinos and Latinas on the U.S.-Mexico border who were born in the United States and who were now going to get their passports. And they were being denied their passports. Essentially, they were being denied their American citizenship, having been born in the United States, because they were Latino or Latina.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell us what happened?
The story broke, a week or two ago. And when it broke, it kind of made me mad, because I've been dealing with this for a while now with my family. So it's not like it was breaking news. The problem had already started. Now, I was born in a little town called San Juan, Texas, which the biggest city next to it is McAllen, Texas. And I come from a mixed status family. It was my mom and four kids. My oldest brother and my mom were undocumented. And my mom passed away before she became a citizen. My brother and my mom took about 20 years to get their resident alien card. And
that green card.
Yeah. You know, and I always say that because I always want people to remember that it was the resident alien card.
Because we're all aliens. Yeah.
You know, so it's like I want people to remember that. And it took my brother about 30 years to become a citizen, you know, and everybody tells you the line, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, there's no fucking line. If you gave a shit so much about the problem, you would know there's no line. But anyway, whatever. So my family grew up very poor. And I decided that when I was coming into money, I would take my family on vacations because we never took a vacation as a kid. And our first vacation was in 2016 as a family. And I decided that the next big trip I wanted to do was to take all of my family to see my mom's village in Mexico. So she grew up in a little rancho called El San Carrón. And, you know, no running water, no electricity, no anything, you know. And I spent some time as a child there, so I told everybody, get your passports. So so that we can go to Mexico. Because we grew up in a time where you didn't need your passports to go to Mexico. Then all of a sudden it stopped, and then we couldn't go back to visit relatives ever again because we couldn't afford food, so we couldn't afford passports. I got my passport before anybody else because I was the more Americanized, the most modern one from my family. I was born from a midwife. So my mom, like my labor cost my mom $250, and she put it on layaway because she couldn't afford $250. You know, so I got my passport like around 2000. But had it been now, I'd be denied a passport right now.
Because you were born through a midwife.
Through a midwife. My brother, Aloy, and my sister, Julie, they were born through a midwife. And now when they applied for a passport, they turned in their birth certificate. They turned in every documentation that you need. And they both got denied. And they said that they need documentation that they're citizens. We don't know what paperwork that is. So they give you a list of potential documents, right? So you have to get school records from your school district. Now, mind you, I'm the youngest. So my brother and my sister, they're in their 50s. So they have to go back, you know, 50 years or so, almost 45, and try to get school records, try to get baptism records, try to get leases, which, by the way, you know, first 7 years of my life, my family were squatters. So we were like homeless. There is no lease, you know, so there is no proof that we actually existed. What bothers me, though, the baptism, the school records, that doesn't show that you were born here. It's just extra paperwork. The most important paper that they got was the birth certificate, and now this country is saying, oh, we take it back, you're not really that.
So, Manuel, seriously, I'm freaking out. I mean, I remember when this happened, I said, how much more information do you need to understand that people of color, specifically Latinos, Latinas, we're being challenged. We are being targeted. As an academic, when you hear the story of what's happened with Cristela's family, what's going on for you?
You know, the day after Trump got elected, after waking up with a pretty serious hangover, I dragged myself into my office and was supposed to give a kind of pep talk to my staff and brought them together and said, it's going to be worse than you think. And I think that's happened because the story you're telling, you know, people are paying a lot of attention to the attacks on undocumented immigrants, mixed status families, and that's very real and very threatening. But there's a big attack on legal immigrants as well, trying to strip citizenship from people who've served in the military. There's a new set of things called public charge, trying to say that if your kids ever got food stamp, he wouldn't be able to become a citizen. And now the newest thing is a big backlog in the citizenship applications. It used to be that about you would wait about 6 months between the time applying for citizenship and becoming a citizen. Now the wait is 1 year and growing. And there are 750,000 aspiring Americans, people who are lawful permanent residents, who want to attain their citizenship, have jumped through all of the hoops to do so, and are simply waiting for their applications to be processed, who are not going to be able to become citizens or vote in these next elections.
I mean, it feels like, what should we call this, Professor Pastor?
Gosh, I'm trying to think of an academic title for it, but...
What shall bullshit? We call it that's not an academic title? What shall we call it that is not an academic?
Well, I think this is academic and non-academic. It's racist. And it's an attempt to prevent a growing population of color that wants to exercise its political rights to become citizens and vote or to engage in the public square in all sorts of other ways and to suppress that. This is of a piece with the voter IDs laws. It is of a piece with all sorts of ways to try to suppress voters. And that's why the 2018 midterm elections are so important. It's also why the census is important in 2020, getting the right numbers there and redistricting, because we need to, again, be patient. We need to lay out a 6-year plan for really changing political power in this country and really combating this kind of racist fanning of demographic anxiety about the way things are changing. And an interesting thing, Mani, which I think is really important, the places in the United States that seem to be the most scared of immigrants don't have them.
I know. They just see Judy and Christella on television, and then they get worried about things, which is kind of crazy.
They're like, Judy took Heather Locklear's job. Like, you know what I mean? It's like that. It's like, you know.
So Judy, what's going on for you as you're listening to... Not the
By
fact
the way,
that you took...
Can I show my age that Heather Locklear was the first person that came to my mind?
But I'm wondering, Judy, as you're listening to the professor kind of talk about what's happening and try and give it some kind of academic historical context, what's actually going on for you?
I mean, I think it's, as I said before, incredible bullshit, and to a great extent, terrifying. I find it irresponsible, you know, that the politicians surrounding this administration have done so little. I'm worried, as you are worried, you know. I was like, what is it going to take? How much loss or what kind of loss are the racist people going to need to experience to actually react to the now unsurprisingly daily terrifying things that we are experiencing as people of color?
In your work, are you feeling revved up because of this?
I am, you know, and I feel vocal. I don't know if it's because of the menopause or I just don't give a fuck.
But getting older does help to not give a shit about things.
But,
I gotta
you know,
say,
I find myself
thing.
More involved and more supportive and more aware of environments where, you know, women, Latinos, people of color, I feel myself more motivated to pursue things that, you know, to present myself creatively and artistically behind the scenes. Because I've never had that. It's like, I'm just an actor. It's just not enough anymore in terms of doing my part of what I do. And I'm proud of the work we've done. My husband and I have been doing an animation for 6 years that tackles racism. That
and
tackles
it's called
it's called La Golda.
La Golda.
And it's challenging even to get funding for a third season because people want to put their money somewhere else. You know what I mean?
All right. So we have a segment called La Última y Nos Vamos, which means the last one before we go. Because we're in Hollywood... To finish off the conversation, I want to ask you, what movie or television series are we not seeing produced right now that you would love to see? So, for example, you know, the Vietnam War era, we had Apocalypse Now. You know, Wall Street, after the crash, we had The Big Short. There are a lot of super important films that have captured a moment. So for you guys, what political topic or social issue is basically screaming for a movie or a television series? Or is it that it's already there? Like, for example, you know, Judy, One Day at a Time, or Claws. You know, it's already happening. Or my favorite also, Queen Sugar. But do you have one, Judy, where you're like, if I could do this?
For me, it's in terms of, again, covering Latinos, it's like, you know, the generalization. There's so many cultures within the Latino community. We need to cover Black Latinos because Dominicans are, you know, Afro-Latinos. And the racial and ethnic issues within our community.
You mean some of that dirty laundry stuff?
Yeah. Within families, within Dominican families in particular, there is, like, colorism. And there's racism, you know. I know growing up in my family, I'm one of four daughters. My oldest is what you call Haba. She's high yellow, you know, dark, light skin, gorgeous with like kinky hair. I'm a twin, and my twin sister's darker than me. I have what you would call the good hair because you don't need to relax it. And my twin sister had to relax her hair, and she's darker. She had, you know, more what they called ordinary features, which are Black women's features. And so there was a bit of a favoritism between me and her. And my younger sister is like, she's an Afro-Latina, a little taller, looks like a model. Even then, my younger sister pursued acting very briefly. She got over it because of those very issues, you know, wanting to be cast as African-American, but identifying a little more complicated, definitely as Black, but definitely a Latina. And that was just too much for her to educate the industry. You know what I'm saying? And
so
and
your favorite show would maybe be a show about Afro-Latinas?
Yes. Or, you know, Dominicanas. The same difference.
Ooh, I like that. A primetime show with Dominicanas. Uh-oh. Manuel, what would be the show that you would love to turn on or movie? Or are you watching it? I mean, I'm watching a lot of this stuff. It feeds me. But what would you like to see?
I, of course, would like to see a movie about an aspiring statistician.
That sounds sexy.
Very sexy.
Who is on the front lines of struggle with community-based organizations. And it would be called Nerds for Social Justice. So. But what I'd really like to see, given what I've been working on and working with over the last couple of years, something really about daily life in South Los Angeles and the way in which the press has played up tensions between African Americans and Latinos without covering the transformations politically and in daily lives and the ways in which people have developed ways of getting along and building community and building really vibrant social change. It's a really inspiring story, and I think it's not told.
Love that. People building bridges and getting along. What a concept. Christella.
I would say one is a vague in theory and one is very specific. I grew up loving A Different World. And for me, that show, because we didn't have Latinos representing us growing up, I really tried to get my pride from the Black community and the shows, because that gave me a sense of love that I could relate to. And for me, when I saw A Different World, it was so empowering to me to see people celebrate their culture and actually feel so honored to be from that culture, because I feel like as a Latina, it is hard to feel honor for the culture when you are taught that you are nothing every day. I wish there was a different world for us right now, because I look at that show and think, I remember feeling proud that those characters were proud, you know? And for me also, I think that just theoretically, I think that we need to have a show where we really have characters that tackle healthcare, both physical and mental, because I feel like right now in this era that we live in, we fight, and we don't know how to take care of ourselves, especially in low-income neighborhoods, people of color. I can specifically say the Mexican neighborhood, you know, like we're not taught to deal with depression. We're not taught to take care of our bodies, and we cannot be expected to fight and win if we physically can't be there and mentally can't be there to fight and try to win. I think that's the story that needs to be told.
And you know what? We want to thank you. We want to say a shout out, though, to One Day at a Time that is dealing with mental health issues, that is dealing with undocumented young people, that is dealing with LGBTQ issues, that is dealing with
PTSD.
PTSD.
Alcoholism.
Alcoholism. So, and yet making us laugh.
Yeah. It's really hilarious and extraordinarily performed by the entire cast, but in particular, Justina Machado and Rita Moreno are just astounding in the show. Yeah. And the writing is very, very funny. It's not, you know, it's just elevated from the Norman Lear era, something that we needed, but, you know, brought into our context contemporarily. And it's fantastic. I'm proud to be a part of it.
And that's a wrap for our Live in the Thick in Los Angeles. Christella Alonso, Jiri Reyes, and Dr. Manuel Pastor, thank you so much for being on In the Thick. And thank you so much to our live audience. And we really want to give special thanks to Michael Stubbs and Dr. Bill Resnick for graciously hosting this live event. I am Maria Hinojosa, and thank you again for joining us on this edition of In the Thick. So, Julio, you know, I missed you very much. This was the first ever live ITT that I've done all by myself. So I did miss having my co-anchor. So what'd you think?
First of all, you were fantastic.
Thank you.
I thought Manuel Pastor, when he was talking about California and the muy muy thing, I laughed so hard when he said that. But then, like, Cristela's story about the passport, she just, like, opened up. And I don't know if she's really, like, been that upfront about it.
She said that she doesn't talk to other journalists about that because she doesn't want them to own them to own her story of her family.
Just listening to it, it was just so amazing. And then Judy Reyes talking about colorism.
I know.
With Dominica. I was like, yo, with that accent, because that New York accent is still out there. And so I really warm up to, like, New York accents. So it was just, like, three amazing guests.
I was mostly having, like, pinch me moments. Like, am I really sitting here talking to both Cristela and Judy, who, by the way, they had never met before. And so, you know, Cristela had a chance to tell Judy, you know, like, wow, like, you're one of my role models. I remember watching you on Scrubs.
I love Judy on Scrubs.
Judy gets younger every year. I told her that. I was like, Judy, you need to stop. You're getting younger. And then Dr. Manuel Pastor, you know, who's this, like, serious academic. I had never seen him so funny.
He was hilarious. But you did a great job.
Thank you, Julio. And I just want to say again, special thanks to Michael J. Stubbs and Dr. Bill Resnick for graciously hosting this live event in their amazing, amazing home. Also, thank you to Daniel Villafor, who was our recording engineer, and to our audience, who, by the way, so total surprise, I look across the room and I'm like, I know that person, but how do I know? Oh my God, I'm a huge fan of Queen Sugar.
The show, yeah.
Bianca Lawson, who plays Darla. And she was there and she loved it. And I was like, oh my God. So thank you to our live audience for coming out. And I just want to say, what a pleasure. We love you, California. We love you, LA. And I'm Maria Hinojosa.
And I'm Julio Ricardo Varela.
Uno, dos, tres.
Remember, your other homework is to go to Apple Podcasts to rate and review us, because this really helps other people to find us. Also, follow us on Twitter and on Instagram at In The Thick Show, and like us on Facebook and tell your family and friends to listen. In The Thick is produced by Juan Pablo Garnham, Stephanie Laveau, and Nicole Rothwell. Our theme music is Comencemos by Jungle Fire, and the music that you heard is courtesy of Nacional Kept and ZZK Records. Hasta la próxima. We will see you next time on In The Thick. Thank you so much for listening to In The Thick.
Gracias.
Nos vemos.
Ciao.
Thank you, mamita. Okay. Woof, woof. Although if we were speaking Spanish, it would not be woof, woof. It would be whoa, 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 whoa. Woof, woof. Whoa, whoa. Let's talk English. All right.
Oh, my God. It's so cute.
Shall we?